Hey everyone, welcome to the Microcast and Microcosm Community Call. This call is recorded live on Friday, September 30th. On this week's edition of Rapid, Not So Rapid Fire Friday, we get into a ton of questions from our team and listeners. We start off by talking about traveling internationally with race nutrition and gear, as well as protein and fat intake during longer ultras. From there, the conversation shifts to race preparation, from choosing A races to how much time to spend in aid stations during events and how to hack the UTMB mandatory gear checks. Our conversation ends with a deeper dive into thinking beyond one race season and giving yourself time to truly improve as a runner before stepping up to longer ultras. I hope you enjoy this episode, and as usual, if you have any feedback, a question for a future call, or are looking for support in your running journey, please visit us on the web at microcosm-coaching.com or contact us at microcosmcoaching@gmail.com.
New link.
Announcement. Next week, there'll be a new link. We'll have another 97 occurrences over the next 2 years or more. I wonder how many calls there are recordings of at this point. A lot. I would imagine a lot. All right. Well, let's get into it. We've got a lot of questions. Awesome. All right. Well, we have, I know on my team, I've got a couple athletes who are doing the Puerta Vallarta UTMB race, and that is coming up in October. And that is an international race. People will be traveling across borders to get there. And so we've got a question here about traveling with nutrition, international travel with nutrition. I think I'll start off by just saying, don't stress about this. I think there's people out there who have had some struggles traveling with their race nutrition, maybe to UTMB and things like that. Don't worry about it. It's not going to get confiscated by TSA.
From your check on. It's, from your checked bag.
If you check your stuff, you're going to be 100% fine.
I think like we were talking about this and like the stories of like the horror stories always spread faster than the 99.99% of stories where it's like, yeah, I checked my bag and it was all fine.
Yeah. So I know for everybody, like international racing. Yeah. It's so awesome. I'm glad that we have athletes who are able to do that. I feel fortunate that Zoe and I have been able to do that. It's tough, right? Like nutrition is really different when you travel to another country, and we definitely want to reiterate, like bring the things that you're used to using, bring extra, plan for, you know, needing extra
S-caps for sure.
All that stuff. Like the
there's nary an electrolyte in France.
Yeah. The aid stations for UTMB are typically not well stocked. So plan on having all of your own stuff. But no, it's going to make it if you put it in your check bag with all the scanning and stuff. We tend to use United, but I know like I've never lost a bag. I think it's extremely rare to at least not even know where your bag actually is with the way that they track that stuff now. So don't worry. Stuff does happen, but I think if you check your stuff, you're going to be fine. Now, let's get into, yeah, maybe some of the other stuff that you might want to bring with you. Sarah, I know you had some great notes on this, so why don't you chime in?
Yeah, so the other stuff, hold on 1 second. Let me pull up my notes really quickly. Sorry. Okay, yeah, so... I think it's really good idea to make sure that you're just following all TSA guidelines. So if you're going to bring your poles, you need to check those. You can't bring those on the plane. And I do think if you are trying to bring nutrition, like TJ said, it's a good idea to just check it. If you are bringing it with you on the plane, definitely keeping things in like sealed containers. You don't want to bring like white powders of Tailwind or like white bag, like a powder that's not labeled, and just like you're going to get a lot of attention for that. And so I would avoid that. And then I think it's a good idea to bring your own food on the plane, your own nutrition. Like, you don't want to be eating airport food, especially like if you're traveling and you're stuck in airports when they're not open, or, you know, it's just nutrition that you're not used to. So bringing your own food, focusing on hydration while you're on the plane, drinking a lot of water, wearing compression socks, getting up and moving, all that stuff, really just like thinking about how you are using that time wisely.
Huge, huge, huge fan of the compression socks. And I'm a little, so like, we have a story coming out on Outside Run today that actually it happened on a plane that TJ and I were on our way back from Chamonix, where Adam Chase, who's a writer for Trail Runner and Outside, he's like 40. He had a stroke on the plane. He's a, you know, works for Brooks, young, fit athlete, like, you know, used to be like a champion mountain runner. And he had like, he has like a somewhat genetic disposition towards blood clots, but just like, didn't get up, didn't walk around, didn't hydrate enough, had been training at altitude, had been kind of like stressed and not getting the same level of exercise when he went to Chamonix, and that caused him to have a stroke on the plane. So like, not to be obviously like, again, like that's like the, you know, 1% of 1% of stories, but like hydrate and don't worry about having to get up and go to the bathroom a bunch of times on the plane. That is so much better than the potential health risks of being underhydrated, and purely being chronically underhydrated, which is really easy to have happen when you're traveling. You're not sitting at your desk with your Nalgene all day. So get yourself a nice water bottle, get like fun drinks, like, you know, don't be afraid to go to the back of the plane and ask for like 3 extra ginger ales. Really make sure you're hydrated on flights.
Yeah, I love that suggestion, Zoe. And I would say also get yourself that aisle seat. If you're a window seat person, yeah. I'm a window seat kind of person, and I really regretted being in the window seat coming back from CCC. I really regretted it. I'm going to be an aisle seat kind of guy from now
aisles
on.
Aisles for life.
And if you're traveling with your partner, just book them the aisle seat on the other side right next to you. So that way you guys can still, you know, be next to each other and no one has to sit in the middle. Kylie, did you had an interesting tip on packing something in your checked bag and in your carry-on. You wanna fill us in on that?
Yeah, so I mainly hydration mix, because I found that some of my, I work with quite a few athletes that travel, like I had some people going to Berlin, and just working with athletes internationally that, are going over there to do races, or even coming to the US, et cetera. Just like the hydration mix piece, I think can be harder for people sometimes to find, especially over in Europe. Putting 2 bags of, and I think Sarah might've mentioned this in her notes too, but like the original packaging. So like 2 bags, unopened original packaging. So then if you just have this white powder, like random thing, like they wouldn't be as, you know, likely to like suspect anything. And it's really, really what I've found is in Europe, like they don't necessarily, no offense, but they don't typically have as good of hydration mix companies. And so finding something comparable can be harder. And then like with the gel side of things, I found there are some comparable companies over there. So I think it would be a little bit easier. That's the only reason why I kind of said putting 2 bags in there and then focusing on the hydration mix in particular, if you like really, really like a particular one.
That's awesome. Yeah, I think that I like to carry Noon on the plane. I've never had an issue with it. Whether it's in a plastic bag or in the container. I think it's just so important to have electrolytes with you when you are traveling for long periods of time.
I think that, can I piggyback off of that, TJ?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, I think, yes, we need to hydrate a lot, but I do see athletes take things to the extreme and they'll, you know, they're just like chugging water. And it's like, you know, you are, that's great. But oftentimes, like, we need some electrolyte to actually pull that fluid in and be able to hold on to it and have it do its job. And if you're just doing water, it can flush out electrolytes. And then once you get to where you're at, if you go running and stuff, like, you're probably not going to feel that great. You can risk hyponatremia. So it is a thing. I've had it happen to athletes. I like the tip of taking your noon or something, like some kind of electrolyte thing, liquid IV element or something like that.
Awesome. Yeah. I think that's really, really key. And also you had a great tip in here about packing balanced snacks and things like that. I think Sarah also mentioned this, but just to reiterate, you know, airport food is not usually the healthiest in the world. So a lot of us have, you know, very specific dietary restrictions and things like that. And I always find that it's helpful for me to, like,
yeah, good luck being vegetarian at DFW, man.
Yeah, it's like best to try to, like, carry on a little bit of food for yourself. That way,
you can eat it something other than Chili's.
Yeah, gosh, it can be so tough.
Which, like, Chili's is fine. Honestly, like, Chili's is not the worst option out there.
And Kylie, what about your note on melatonin here?
Oh, I was just, I think mentioning, like, it can, first off, you don't want to overuse melatonin. So if you, like, habitually use it, it can definitely decrease your internal production of melatonin, your natural production of it. So I don't recommend using melatonin regularly, but if you know you're somebody that it does work for, it can be a good strategy with jet lag to just kind of utilize that at the time of day that's necessary. I find extended release to be a good option. And then some people are like, oh, it doesn't work. And they got, like, the 1 milligram of melatonin. You can take up to 10 milligrams of melatonin. So if you've used 1 milligram and it hasn't worked, you can definitely try and up that a little bit. And I know the other note I wanted to make, I know TJ, I think you said this for yourself in a conversation we had, but it can make you, some people feel groggy the next day. So potentially, like, if that's you or you don't really want to feel that way or something, there are alternatives. Like, you could do chamomile tea. Actually does have some good research behind it to help with sleep promotion. So chamomile tea, utilizing something like a magnesium complex or something, not magnesium oxide or citrate. Those are not the best for sleep promotion, but magnesium glycinate or threonate. So, you know, there's alternatives to melatonin, but I guess I was making a note on that for jet lag, because sometimes that can be tough for people, or even if sleeping in a new place can be hard too.
Absolutely. I think that those are all really great points and totally relevant to the conversation. I really regretted not bringing melatonin to Europe. I really struggled with sleep for like 7-8 days. Yeah, it's definitely something that helps a ton. And that's kind of in the same vein, while I've got you here, Kylie, and we're talking about nutrition and preparing for races, say we've got an athlete who is traveling for a 100-miler, maybe it's their first one. They have heard that it can be helpful to eat protein and fats later in the race. Is that true? Should they prepare for that? Why should they do that? And how much should they eat?
I need to unmute myself. Sorry. I think number one, you always need to prepare for your fueling plan for 100-miler. So you shouldn't just go into it and be like, well, I'm just going to eat a bunch of avocado later in the race, and I've never practiced with that. I think it's important to remember that when you're first starting an event, utilizing carbohydrate strictly or skewing your intake towards carbohydrate at the beginning, because you're typically going to be going at a little bit higher percentage of your VO2 max. I'm not saying you're going to go out like all out sprint here, but we're typically feeling a little bit better at the beginning. So using carbohydrate there is a good idea. And then as the event goes on, mixing in some protein and fat can be helpful for certain people. I'm not saying everyone needs to do this either, because I've had athletes strictly use hydration mix and gels and be fine for 100 miles. So again, testing is really important. But if you include some protein, I like to start thinking about introducing that like around the 4 hour mark, and a little bit every hour. We're not talking like a hamburger every hour or anything. We're talking about like 8 to 10 grams, which isn't a ton, but it can help prevent muscle protein breakdown and attenuate like a bit of soreness in the legs. And it can also help with central nervous system fatigue a little bit. So you can do that by, I mean, even potatoes have a little bit of protein, or some people use a BCAA powder in their drink mix as well as an addition. But again, I'm practicing, that might not work for some people. So protein wise, yes. Fat wise, I think again, that's more of a case by case basis. Fats, the reality is they are broken down very slowly in the body. And even if you're moving pretty slowly, your GI system is probably also moving pretty slowly in a 100 miler. And so fats can be a tough one to kind of break down and fuel with. So if you're going to do it, I would say like smaller amounts, again, like 8 to 10 grams of fat an hour. And you can trial that in your training. Like I'll have people use nut butters pretty successfully, but they're not using like half a jar of peanut butter again. So it's like the serving size of it. And you still want to keep in mind, you want to get a minimum amount of carbohydrate in per hour, which is usually 30 to 40 grams. So we definitely don't want to go, oh, well, I'm just going to use fat to fuel, you know? So having that mix, I would say number one, it does for some people help break up palate fatigue and that sweetness fatigue. But then you also want to keep in mind that protein and fat are digested more slowly. So just be careful on the amounts, and you can kind of weave those in a little bit.
Awesome. Thank you. And I think one of the big takeaways there too is make sure you practice this stuff on your long runs. Take the guesswork out of all of this. Protein and fats can cause a lot of GI distress, especially if you're not used to, you know, trying to process and digest those things under the stress of racing 100 miles, a lot of stress. So really make sure that you practice that stuff in your training. Make sure you know how you're going to respond to it before you do that. Try not to do new things during your races if you can. Cool. Well, we had another question, kind of not in the nutrition vein, but it's about UTMB mandatory gear. I know, again, we've got some athletes who are preparing for Puerto Vallarta, and that is a UTMB race. And so they do require the UTMB required gear, which is...
Is it the same?
It's the same.
That
it's so
I take
fun.
Issue with that. That actually to me is really troubling, because the climates are radically different in like...
Oh, you mean 100 degrees and 100% humidity is different than 45 degrees?
I think this is like one of those things where I'm like, I'm glad we're talking about like all the workarounds, because I'm going to be using many of those, because like when I did MCC, which like was a 5 hour race, like I had to take a full rain suit, and I didn't like take any of the shortcuts that I probably should have, because like I landed in France like 20 hours before I had to race. So I was just like jet lagged out of my mind. But at a certain point, I think some of the gear really does make sense. And I understand why they do it for liability issues. And there's like thousands and thousands of people out there, and most of them are not front of the pack, because that's how the front of the pack works, is that it's only a few people. But I think it can actually be more dangerous to bring gear that's not really well thought out and isn't appropriate for the climate, just to like cover some administrator's ass.
Well, if your opinion mattered, we all be carrying a lot less.
My opinion does matter. I'm a journalist. Well, I'm a thought leader.
I feel like this is a great opportunity for you to write an op-ed. I would fully support this, because I don't like to carry a lot of useless things. I'm a light pack kind of guy, although I've come around to the pack this year.
By force,
I had to get used to the pack, and now I really like the pack. but there are some workarounds. I don't have the list of gear in front of me. You guys can all look that up. But there are a few workarounds, and I know we have a lot of other athletes on the team who have had experience racing UTMB races or in races in Europe that have the same, basically the same mandatory gear. You know, one of the things that I like to tell athletes is don't short yourself on the rain jacket. They are actually really strict about that.
I mean, they're strict on all the stuff.
Yeah, that was the one piece of gear that during CCC they actually checked, and they actually made me wear it, even though I didn't really want to.
I mean, I got gear checked my first year running MCC, and I think they checked for for me, it was like gloves, cell phone, and rain jacket.
Yeah. So you've got to, the headlamp trick, I think, is a great way to cut down on weight. When you're racing these events, you have to carry two headlamps
and a backup battery
for both headlamps. And so my advice is to get one really great headlamp, 200 lumens at least. And to have a very accessible, like, backup battery for that, because usually the more lumens your headlamp is, the quicker it runs out of batteries, right? Because it's brighter and it needs a lot more power to operate.
Although a lot of the, like, I use a BioLite headlamp, and they scale the battery size to match the lumens so that they all have more or less the same amount of battery life on their highest beam.
That's cool. I mean, there are so many different headlamp options out there. Choose the one that you feel is right for you. I think there's always that compromise, right, between like lightness and in terms of like how heavy is it actually, and then how much brightness you can get out of it. You got a super bright lamp that also has a very big battery pack, it's going to be heavier. And so there's just tons of options and tons of brands. I don't think there's any one best option. Yeah.
A workaround I saw for the shorter races, because like for MCC and OCC, which are the 40K and the 55K respectively, they still required you to have a second headlamp, which, like, you know, yeah, there's some people that are like, yeah, it's going to take you a full day to run OCC, I guess. But if you're pretty confident that it's not going to take you all that extra time to run a 50K or a 40K, a backup I've seen for the headlamp is my friend Ashley Brosovan used the little bike lights that they give out free at like every event in Boulder, like just the little silicone with a light in it. And that can be a really great way of finding something that technically fits the description for having a backup light, but weighs almost nothing and takes up no additional space.
And again, like the batteries for something like that are usually watch batteries, so they're very, yeah, very small. I didn't use something like that for CCC, but I did use an emergency headlamp, which is it basically weighs nothing. I think it was like, I don't know.
Basically, you had one that you were not planning on using.
Yeah, very, very small, very lightweight. And so that workaround is awesome. That's going to save you quite a bit of weight. Another workaround is the leggings workaround. So everybody, you have to have this duplicate piece of gear, UTMB races, where you have rain pants that are waterproof. And then you also have to have full length leggings or pants that are not waterproof to wear underneath those. And so for most people, I think especially North Americans, that feels extremely redundant. Why would you do that? A lot of athletes use pantyhose instead of full length running tights. It's essentially, they are leggings. They're functional if you can actually fit into the pair that you've purchased. I'd never tried mine on, but great workaround. They are super small. They pack down really like into like something that's like the size of your fist, rather than, I don't know, something that's more like this big in your, the size of a raincoat or something. Like, leggings are not the lightest thing in the world. So I would definitely recommend that as well as a good workaround, especially like, we want this stuff to be functional because potentially like you might need it in an emergency situation, but what, you know, maybe if you're racing Puerto Vallarta, what are the chances you're going to have to put like something that you would wear in winter on in a race that's happening in a jungle?
I think it really comes down to risk assessment and knowing yourself. Like, yeah, for me, you know, if I was running CCC, there is a non-zero chance that I might have the worst day of my life and end up like walking it in and needing the full pants leggings thing. I actually think the strategy is to not assume that the hacks are going to be useful. I think that like those are really like barely clearing the bar for like this technically counts, but I would not bank on using them other than to pass the gear check.
That's so, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So like, know yourself. Like for me, I would take the risk. Like, yeah, I'm going to bring pantyhose because hope to God, I'm not going to be out here running CCC for 40 hours.
I mean, I was, and I didn't have to wear my
pantyhose. You weren't there for 40 hours. Yeah. And again, like know yourself. Yeah. And practice with your gear.
I would also recommend the rain jacket, again, can be a really heavy piece of gear. There are so many different options out there. I know that if it is a wet race, probably one rain jacket is not going to be enough. You may need to change out a jacket because eventually...
That's something ideally your crew could bring for you, or you could have in a drop bag, because like carrying your drop bag on your back is not a strategy I would recommend.
Well, the point of what I was saying actually was that you're going to probably have multiple jackets, right? So depending on the weather, you can choose the one that's lightest, least waterproof, if it's not going to rain, if you're not, if it's going to be a beautiful day. And then if you think that there's going to be bad weather, then you put in the heavier duty one that weighs more. I know a lot of athletes over the years have collected many different pieces of gear. I know that I have. And so for CCC, I had like a jacket that was really light and would pass the gear check, but would definitely, I would get wet eventually. It wasn't quite as waterproof as my FutureLite jacket. And so then the weather report was like, it's going to rain the whole time. So then I took the FutureLite jacket instead, which weighed a little bit more. Those windbreaker type jackets though are not going to pass the test. Also, you're going to get soaked and very cold. So don't.
Also, they don't. Those. Yeah. They have to be. What is it? Sealed seams.
Sealed
tape seams.
Yeah.
I'm really a huge fan of the North Face flight jacket. Size up though, so it goes on over your shell.
Yeah, that's the key. Size up, and North Face runs really tight. So if you're buying one of those,
it's a sporty fit.
Honestly, like go two sizes up. I went a size up, and it was still too small. Well, those are my only hacks. I mean, there's not that many ways to hack this, to hack the system, the leggings.
I feel like there have jacket. To be though, because when you look at some of the like I the think, pros packs,
I think they look just,
you think they're just like, gear. If I get the time penalty.
Yeah. They just the drop gear while they're out there and they didn't get checked and they didn't bring the stuff. That's my theory on that. Talked to a lot of people impossible. About that as well, who have the same opinion.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they're just leaving gear. Don't do that though.
You don't do want not support that strategy.
Yeah, exactly, Zena. It's 10,000. I don't know the specific like metric there for measuring that, but
like not a Patagonia Houdini. Not gonna cut it.
Yeah, you need to be able to withstand quite a lot of water resistance on the jacket before the jacket becomes saturated. So like a really waterproof, probably a Gore-Tex option like Tom referenced to here, the shake dry jackets and things like that. Yeah, very, very important to have. All right, let's move on. That was a little gear talk. I wish there was more hacks, honestly. If right. you guys come I've across actually always more wanted hacks, to do that let me
story
know.
Story for Trail Runner, an interview, because I was like really interested in that.
Yeah.
Like apparently Sally McRae, when she did UTMB, was like got super into having the lightest pack she could possibly have and got like a mini cell phone. Like, but I mean, again, like some of the rules, I'm just like, this is so dumb. Like they require you to carry your phone and to have it on and data on the whole time, which like, unless you're literally Killian, like your phone's going to die out there. Oh, so like you have to bring all these backup battery. Like, I don't know. A lot of the stuff just doesn't feel grounded in reality to me.
That's okay. It's got to be a liability thing.
Yeah, totally. But again, like, I think making people carry stuff to protect the race director is maybe not, like, I don't know. I'm sure there's a more thoughtful way of putting that.
It's hard to say, right? We're not race directors. We'll have to ask Jen and Pete.
At the end of the day, I don't know anything about directing a race.
All right. Well, we do know something about racing. So this question is about race strategy. How long is it a good amount of time to stay at an aid station? What do you put in your drop bags or do at aid stations? Love this question.
Yeah. Because, like, I'm almost like, it looks like this, the way that this is phrased, it almost seems like the best amount of time is the least amount of time you can spend without being rushed.
Let's start with shorter races. Drew, you made some good points here. I want to get you involved in this conversation. And even from a road racing perspective, like marathon or half marathon, you know, what do you see athletes doing? What do you recommend to your athletes?
Yeah. So I know that a lot of what we discuss on these calls is very ultra marathon heavy because a lot of our runners are ultra marathoners. But like TJ said, there's a ton of people in Microcosm that are shorter distance people too. So we don't want y'all to think that we've forgotten about you. When it comes to shorter races, even something as short as like a 5K, 10K, half marathon, really even marathon, I'd say, the idea is that you are not stopping at aid stations. You're never stopping for a couple reasons. One, it's rude, right? Other people are in there trying to get a product as well, water, Gatorade, maybe a gel, something like that. And stopping there really inhibits other people's ability to get aid. And another is it's kind of dangerous. The idea is most people are running through aid stations on the move. You're trying to like break 30 minutes in the 5K or whatever it is, that's really big deal. And stopping for 10, 15 seconds can really, you know, make that difficult at times. But with other people running through aid stations, you stopping at one, it makes you a hazard. It can be dangerous. Running into people is not uncommon at races where you're maybe running a little faster. And so, yeah, that can be dangerous. Another thing is if you are, I mean, it takes practice, right? I have a lot of my shorter distance athletes who are maybe doing a race for the first time where there's aid stations or a aid station in the race. It can be intimidating, right? To like come up to this table with volunteers and people yelling at you, water, Gatorade, and freaking out. And you to like get there and be like, what do I do? What do I do? So maybe like, practicing that, as silly as it sounds, maybe like a small table in front of your house when you're doing your strides or something like that, where you can just like run by and practice like snagging a cup or something like that, just so you kind of know how to work it, just so you're less intimidated so that you can run through aid stations and not stop is important. And if for whatever reason you get to the point where you are just, you don't feel like you're good enough to run and grab and snag water and do all that at the same time, at least walking through the aid station, cannot emphasize it enough. Do not stop. Do not get to that table and then like post up there and just like stop. You have to keep moving. And so that's kind of my deal. I know that changes with some longer races, which I know that we'll talk about, but short races, you gotta keep moving.
Thanks, Drew. And I think like just piggybacking off that and moving into some of these longer races, the idea of being efficient is really key. I know every athlete that I work with has some kind of performance goal going into a race, whether that's just staying in front of the cutoffs and getting that race done, or it's pushing like sub 24 out of 100 or sub 6 out of 50K, whatever it is, there's always some kind of time elements that we're working with here. So being efficient in the aid stations is really, really, really key. Zoe, you've got a lot of thoughts on this.
I do.
I want to turn it to you.
Yeah, because like, again, the way this question is worded kind of freaks me out. So it's like they're looking for permission to like hardcore chill at the aid station, like got to get my 11 minutes in. No, don't do that. I think, yeah, talking with, I think one of my favorite aid station stories is Kylie's husband, Sean, was pacing a guy at Hard Rock who was like ended up coming in 10th in the top 10, but like had some pretty hardcore chill minutes at like the aid station, trying to like hang out, eat a hoagie, get to know everyone at the aid station. And that's not always a great strategy to have. The way I work through this with athletes is telling them to have a plan before they go into the aid station. Talk that through with your crew if they're going to be there first. Like I leave when I do hundreds, I leave my crew with really specific instructions as to like the order I want to do things in, the kind of tempo I want to have when I'm going through an aid station, what I want to look and feel like, and what kind of information I want them to give me. And then I think of breaking the aid station down into three steps. So step one, drop your trash, get your hydration, not stop. Like there are times where it might feel tempting to not stop. Like if you're on the fence, like, oh, maybe I can skip this aid station, save a couple minutes. Always get that water. Like that's really not the best, like always get that hydration, sports drink, water, whatever you're using. Not stopping now might save you a couple minutes then, but you might add a bunch of time on in the med tent later if you're not careful. Step two, grab your gels and other sports nutrition. Even if you think you're not going to want it, or if you don't feel hungry then, take it anyway. I guarantee you'll be grateful that you have them later. Talk through how your fueling is going through with your crew. Update them on how you're feeling. Like for me, I'll like tell my crew like, hey, like spring nutrition's not working as well right now. I'm going to take more goos. That kind of stuff can really help keep your crew looped into how things are feeling, what changes might need to be made down the line. Like if I'm like, hey, I can't do anything sweet right now. Like let's get some more savory gels or whatever in my bag for later down the road. Three, if you are fueling with whole foods, if you're doing potatoes, mashed potatoes, breads, cookies, things like that, that should be step three at the aid station, because by that time your heart rate should have dropped a bit more and you'll be able to better digest those more challenging to digest foods. But again, make sure that you're going into the aid station with a plan and you're ready to execute. And I think it's really important that you drive the aid station experience as the racer, and you don't let the aid station just happen to you. You don't want your crew to just like wash over you. When you're able to stay in control and autonomous in this experience, you're actually going to be a lot more active and engaged in your race. And mentally, that can be really, really important.
Absolutely. One of my process-oriented goals is when I'm maybe a half mile out from an aid station, that's my cue to start thinking about what I need. So I have that plan. I'm going in and I can really respond to the things that I'm feeling rather than frantically react in the aid station itself and waste a lot of time. In these big events, I mean, really in any event where you're pushing an unfamiliar distance to you or doing something that is challenging, let's just make sure that you try to avoid sitting down. It can be really, really hard to get back up when you sit down during, you know, one of these events, even a 5K, if it's your first 5K and you've never crush the distance and you sit down, my God, you're going to stiffen up. It's going to be so mentally tough to get back up and keep moving. So let's really, 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 really work on avoiding that, especially my 100-mile runners. Don't sit down unless you have a big reason to.
If you can, change shoes standing up.
All right, Sarah, what do you put in your drop bags?
One thing with aid station or drop bags, you know, really it's part of that preparation process of like, I think when you're coming into the aid station, you know, what you want, you know, how you're feeling, all that stuff. But the things you really want to be thinking about ahead of time are like, what is the environment going to be like over the next few hours before I'm at the next aid station? So is the sun going to set? Is the sun going to come out? Am I going to need to get my headlamp? Am I going to need to get sunglasses? Like thinking things like that. So when I'm planning my aid stations, I'm really trying to guess as best I can what time of day that's going to be, and I'm putting things in that I might need to pick up, you know, in case I don't see my crew. My headlamp's in there so I can grab my headlamp if my crew's not there, that kind of stuff. And then always enough gels for how many hours I think I'm going to be out, plus a couple more, and then a GI kit
and a first aid kit, like blister stuff, those sorts of things, and then change the socks and change the shoes. But really, I used to pack so many things in my drop bags, and I really learned that it was just like anxiety. It was like me just wanting to plan for every single contingency. And really, like, the aid stations have most things that you're going to need. There's a med tent there. So it's just those basic like socks, shoes, food that you need, and then whatever you need for the next section of the course.
Awesome. I think you really nailed it. Yeah. Thank you, Sarah. Great job. All right, let's move on to another question here. Oh, what do we want to cover? All right, how about race planning? Since we were talking, this isn't a roundabout way, race strategy and race planning are somewhat related. This question is so broad, but it's how does everybody pick an A race? Kylie, you wanna jump in on this one?
Yeah, I think that, and I think we've covered this before on previous calls, but trying to pick things that kind of speak to you is what I usually go with. And athletes will be like, well, can you like pick a race for me? Or can you tell me what to do? And I'm usually like, I mean, I really think that you should be doing something that you want to do, you know? And when I'm picking races, I'm like, oh, what would be like a cool place to go, or interesting course, or something that would challenge me. Or sometimes we'll do like racecation things, you know, like we'll go on a trip and do a race. And so maybe utilizing that strategy to pick your race might be a good idea for you. But I think it's really important to assess like why. It kind of brings you back to like, why am I doing this as well? If you are wanting to race, like you should be able to pick a race that kind of speaks to you. That's, I mean, I feel like that's a thing for the athletes that I work with. And I'm happy to offer guidance to people like, what are you interested in doing? And then they'll give me a list, and then I will say like, hey, like this one, I've heard really great things about it. If it's interesting to you, then let's do it. You know, like it's kind of that collaborative effort in that sense, but I still have the athlete kind of pick their list of things. And then I can help offer guidance and suggestions on appropriateness for like amount of time we have for training and all of that too.
Yeah, great points, Kylie. And I think you really nailed it. Like, it's just not appropriate for a coach to, for many reasons, to pick goals for an athlete. These goals have to be personal to you. They have to reflect your values, your interests, maybe your why. It doesn't have to be deep. It doesn't have to be some crazy.
You don't have to shoehorn a narrative onto your why.
Absolutely not.
It's okay. Like, my why is because I like running.
Yeah.
Like, fully not overthought. I like it. Not out there to see God, not out there to, I don't know, be a better person. Really, I just like running.
I think that it's important to note that. And like, we don't have to over index on how to pick these races, but they do have to reflect your interest, because at the end of the day, you're going to have to train really, really hard to accomplish these goals. And if you think anything other than that, you're going to have a rude awakening. Hate to break it to you. And so, you know, for me, the biggest thing is like when I choose a big A race, it's like, does this race allow me to live the kind of life I want to live? And if the answer to that is yes, then I'll do it. And I can race a bunch of very different things and still answer that question the same way. Yes. And so, you know, you really have to think about that as an athlete. And when you're leveling up and trying to go for a distance that you haven't done before, or a time that you haven't gone before, again, you know, asking yourself, you know, why is that? Am I doing that for me? Do I enjoy challenging myself? Do I enjoy doing the work that sets me up for that success or failure? Am I okay with failing at this goal? You know, like asking yourself those things is important. When you answer those things yes, and you can do so without all of the external variables that may play a role in that. Like, oh, it'd be so fun to talk about this on social media or to tell all my friends about this. Like, you know, try to take those things out of the equation when you make your decision. These have to be personal to you. I think that for athletes, it's choosing a goal that you would do no matter what, even if you couldn't tell anybody about it.
If you were the only person left on earth, what would you do with your time?
Yeah, totally. And if it wouldn't, you know, if you wouldn't spend it running 100 miles,
don't run 100.
Don't run 100
That's
miles.
That's fine. Don't run 10. Don't do anything that doesn't speak to your soul.
Absolutely.
And if you don't love long runs, if you don't on Saturday, if the last thing you want to do is run for 6 hours by yourself, don't do 100. That's fine.
Totally. I think the cool thing about like picking an A race is hopefully you've built up a lot of experiences over time that help to inform the decision that you're making. When we choose to dedicate part of a year to a specific race, which, you know, that's usually what A races require, is quite a bit of focused effort and time going towards one singular thing where the outcome is unfortunately uncertain, even if you really do the work well. Making sure that, you know, you've looked back at your past experiences. Oh, I really enjoyed like doing X, Y, and Z. So like, that's why I'm probably going to really enjoy working towards this A race or picking this A race and actually like spending all day trying to finish that goal at the A race itself. You know, if you're seeing some red flags there, you know, you might want to just take a couple steps back and really reflect on whether or not that goal is right for you.
Yeah. I mean, for me, like after I DNF'd Western States, like I had some people ask like, man, do you like regret like the training? Like you have to really like, you know, I gave up a lot of spring skiing. I gave up a lot of stuff with friends. And ultimately, even after I had like the opposite of the outcome that I wanted, I would have done all that anyway, you know, like Western States was just one more way of giving myself permission to do what I want to do, which is like run all spring and winter.
Yeah.
And that's how I know that it was a good goal for me, regardless of the outcome. So like, do the thought experiment that even if you have the worst day imaginable, like, you know, maybe, you know, similarly TJ for CCC, not that you had the worst day imaginable, but like you still got to do some sick mountain adventures. Like you still got to do some really fun training days with Sean. You spent a lot of time projecting the course itself over in France, Switzerland, and Italy. And it feels like that seemed like it was a really fun and rewarding journey for you, regardless of what the outcome was. Like, it didn't feel like you were sacrificing anything. If the training always feels like it's defined by sacrifice, I think we need to assess what our goals are.
Absolutely. And I think when you get to the point of being at your A race and whatever the outcome is, if you feel unfulfilled by that outcome, it's often a sign that the process and the journey wasn't done as a fulfilling way as it could have been. And I think that's why like I've had really no issue moving past having a bad day at CCC, because it was all about how great the journey was. And so that is really the most important thing. It's the journey that changes us. It's the journey that makes us become, you know, better versions of ourselves. It's not that actual race. It's all the work and the trials and the ups and downs that go into preparing for that race or whatever goal it is, whether it's something in career or, I don't know, with family, financial, whatever it is, it's always the journey that's really providing the context. It's often that we over-index on the actual event itself. And then we forget that, like, oh, why do we feel this way? Oh, it's because of all the stuff that we did that got us here. And so I really try to remind athletes about that. Like, you've got to really want to be fully invested in that journey. And if you're not, you know, you need to think about a different goal.
Yeah. And that's okay. Like, I think like for me, like the thing that bums me out the most about athletes' journeys is when they like work really hard. They run their first ultra, they run their first 100, and then they're like, I just don't want to do this anymore because it felt like I sacrificed too much. And that makes me feel like, man, we should have been striving for more balance the whole time.
I mean, gosh, the amount of athletes who have quit, I it's probably 50 or more people that I've coached over the past 5 years who have quit for that exact reason. And it's always so tough because those people have so much potential to do so much more in running, but the they over-index on something that was too far outside of where they were actually at. And it's not my job as a coach to check that. Like, the athlete needs to go through that experience and hopefully recognize it and be able to make changes then, therefore, afterwards. But that process, if you're not there for it, if you really feel burned out by it after you've completed your goal, that tells me automatically that goal was not right for you.
Yeah.
Like, if your reaction to having done the work and accomplished an amazing goal is then to quit, that right there is a strong sign that that goal wasn't appropriate.
Yeah.
And it's really hard because it takes a lot of self-awareness. And that's why, you know, and we can kind of segue this into the next question, but that's why I'm always pushing my athletes to zoom out and to look at things season after season after season, rather than I have to do 3 200-mile races next year. No, you don't have to do that. In fact, like, if you do that, the potential for you to never race another season again is so high, and you're going to slow down, and we're not working towards you becoming a better runner in the long term, and all of these things. And so, like, when you're thinking about, like, oh, should I get, and this question is related to, like, I want to get faster, should I hold off on doing 100Ks and longer events? It's like, yeah, maybe you should hold off on doing those longer events, because the farther we go, the longer the event, the more we have to slow down. At the event itself, it really afterwards
depends too on the level of athlete and kind of what your training baseline is. I'll say for myself, like, I could have PR'd my marathon, and I'm pretty sure I could have PR'd my 5K right before Western States, because the way I was training for that event, I was like at my athletic best. And that's not always going to be the same. Like, had I been training for Hard Rock, would have been real different, you know?
Well, I think the context there is that had you been training for Western States or Hard Rock, it wouldn't have mattered, because you would have put in so much focused long-term work, building, yeah, running economy, all of these things.
That it wasn't an either or.
Right, exactly. And so athletes often forget, like, oh, I have to do this hunt. Like, I need to do all this specific training to get ready for that. It's like, yes, you do. But if we put that big stretch goal at the right moment, not only does it reflect where you're at in the process and all of these long-term adaptations that we've made that then we get to level up on with specific adaptation, it's also that we're like living our lives the way we want to live them. We're improving, we're practicing mastery and these long-term approaches to getting better at things, which then allow you to really be successful and go after those goals. And it's not something that happens in a year. Like, I don't know how many of you guys listen to the SWAT podcast, but I listen to it every once in a while. And something that I often hear in there or in other pieces that David writes for Trail Runner is that potential in running is a 10-year process. It's not a 1-year process, which is what we require our athletes to commit to. And that is true. I mean, you don't build the aerobic foundation needed to really do well at 100K or 100 miles or even a 5K. Even a 5K, guys, in 1 year of running, that is such a small amount of time. I hate to say it because it, like, I know it's hard, but when I committed to working with my coach, I committed to 5 years. I had never met David. We had only had a conversation in email, and I straight up, he asked me to commit to 5 years, and I committed to 5 years. We're almost at 5 years now, and like, the difference that I've had to zoom out, I have tons of times reflected on goals that I've had and said, you know, this doesn't allow me to live my life the way I want. Yeah, I spent $300 on that race. I've got to just not do it and go back to the beginning and start here and work on these things and build that foundation. And like, all the time checking myself, you know, it's taken me 4.5 years to do 100K. Essentially, if not more, considering all of the running I did before I even had a coach, and when I was self-coaching and all of that. And these processes take a long, long time. So when is there ever a right time to level up? I'm not sure. That's a time that that's something that you have to talk with your coach about and come to a conclusion with regard to. And I don't want people to like wait for their dream race their whole life and then never get to do it, because that's not fun either. But, you know, if we're thinking about things in realistic terms, I think 5 years is not even enough. You know, think 10 years. And are you ready to commit to that? I'm not sure. I can't offer 10-year commitments because I would put myself out of business. I'm running a business, but
if we could, we would.
Because yeah, like, that's the point we want to make, is that this stuff takes a lot of time, and improving. It just doesn't take 1 year or one season of racing.
Yeah.
That might have been.
I find that comforting. But I feel like sometimes it freaks people out. Like I feel very comforted. Like, you know, looking at my own career. Right now, I'm still 10 years younger than a lot of the women that finished top 10 at Western States. That's like super exciting to me. Like, especially to see these women who are, you know, like they have families, they have like really amazing, fulfilling careers and like in, you know, like really crazy, hardworking fields. Like, that's the stuff that really compels me. Like, I've never wanted to be a flash in the pan athlete. I've never wanted to be someone who just dabbles and run. And like, I know that our relationship to running is like, it's going to be different for everyone, but for me it has always been a lifelong journey. And like, the athletes that I'm always the most excited to work with are the folks who, like, it's always been part of their life, it's always going to be part of their life. What part it is might change, but I always, like, I don't understand, and I'm trying to say this from a place of like humility and not judgment, but like, people who are like able to just be like, yeah, I want to take a break from running, but not because of like injury or like a health reason, or like, you know, there's going to be times where, like, you know, mentally, like, it's not always going to work with your family, or like, I understand that like sometimes life is going to require like, oh yeah, you might need to take a little time off for your body, but I don't know, the mental, like, if you feel like you're burnt out from running, usually it means we approach something in the wrong way. And I always want to know from my athletes, like, if we're doing something to get ready for a race and it's making you feel like you might need to take like a season off after, we need to change our approach, because that's not good for the long term.
100%. I think you really nailed it, Zoe. And I love that you, yeah, have just grown to look at things beyond one season. And that's a skill that every athlete really should be striving to have as part of their, like, their tool set, something that they can just automatically pull from when times get tough, when, like, you know, family life becomes the priority, or, you know, you have an injury or a setback or something that, you know, doesn't feel like it's in alignment. And like, as athletes, that is part of the process. Like, that is literally probably more of a valuable part of the process than anything else, because it's in kind of those moments that it's often we learn the most about ourselves. It's when things are going right and we're joyously, you know, running around the mountains and getting our speed workouts in and doing everything, and it feels like there's so much flow. You know, yeah, maybe we're adapting and great stuff is happening, but I think like on really on deeper levels, which is something I know a lot of athletes are striving for, you know, that stuff comes through the trials. And that's really when we really feel like we're, I don't know, far from home or from our base, or when we feel out of touch, that's really where the good stuff starts to happen. And so, you know, for the author of this question, you know, should I hold out on longer events? I would say, yeah, maybe. Think about, you know, what is a realistic time frame to approaching 100K as your best self, as your best athletic self. And everybody here has so much potential that has yet to be discovered. And that's simply because you haven't been training for long enough. It's simply that. The more we train, the longer we give ourselves to get better, the more our talents express themselves. It's so important, especially in running, which is a sport that just requires so much consistency. So I want everybody to think about that. You know, it's something that I think about. You know, I might run 100-miler next year. Maybe I won't, though. You know, that it's, you have no idea. I think you put a goal on the schedule and you do your best to plan for that. And then, you know, you have to also respond and adapt to what life gives you and how you feel as you're working towards those goals and getting closer to them. And so all of this stuff is really interconnected if you think about it and just zoom out a little bit. Don't put the pressure on yourself of having to do it all in one season. If you're thinking about things in terms of 1 year, yes, that might be great a little bit, but try to zoom out even farther. Where do you want to be in 3 years? Where do you want to be in 5 years?
Physiologically, your high-end speed is going to be more age limited than your endurance.
Totally. But we're also seeing signs of that in marathon in both and women
but like,
who are
yeah,
in
again,
their late 30s.
How old is Kipchoge?
Mid to late 30s.
Yeah.
And, you know, other athletes as well who are just crushing late in life and maybe their VO2 max isn't what it was when they were 21, but their aerobic base, they're firing. And it's amazing to see that. Great. Well, we're over a little bit. Thanks, everybody. Thank you, coaches, for your contributions in the call. Really enjoyed this. We've got to put out another Zoom link, 97 calls. I don't know when we started that, but that's a crazy number. I'm going to email everybody the new Zoom link. We will not have a call next week because most of the coaches are traveling, but we're going to pick it back up on the 14th. And we have a call on how to work through and respond to training setbacks set for the 14th. So I hope you guys can join us for that one.
Woohoo!
Yeah, have a great weekend.